The Health and Human Services Committee will now come to order. Sabrina, please call the roll.
Chair Fawn.
Here.
Representative Barrero.
Here.
Anderson.
Here.
Skidmore.
Here.
Amnesty excused. Baker.
Here.
Cross.
Here.
Dunkley.
Here.
Edmonds.
Here.
Grant. Here. Hart. Excused. Coster.
Here.
Masula.
Here.
Persons of Mullica excused. Plakin.
Here.
Salzman.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Shabuzi excused. Tuck.
Here.
Woodson excused. Yurkowski.
Here.
Present is quorum. Present. Quorum is present.
Thank you, and thank all of the members here for making the trip up. I think we may be the only committee that's meeting today, so thank you all for coming up to do that. I guess we're the exciting thing going on in the Capitol as a result. As we begin the meeting, I ask everyone to silence your cell phones and any other electronic devices. Members, today we're going to have a presentation on something that I don't think is controversial, but I think it's important that we know about it because you know, we measure, I think, our priorities by how we take care of the most vulnerable among us, and so we're going to hear a little bit about that today. We're going to have a briefing on the Home and Community-Based Services Waiver pre-enrollment list. And so, again, there's no gotchas here. I think it's just trying to learn a little bit more about this situation and the people who need our help. So I'm going to ask you to hold your questions until the end of the presentation. And then we can have a fulsome question and discussion. With us from APD is Lorena Fulcher, the Deputy Director of the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. You're welcome to come on up. And when you get here, you are recognized. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can now. Yeah.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Fine, Vice Chair Borrero, and members of the committee. As he said, my name is Lorena Fulcher, and I'm honored to serve as the Deputy Director of Operations at the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. We're thankful for the opportunity to be before you this morning to provide a brief overview of our pre-enrollment processes. Committee, I'd like to start by thanking the governor and the legislature for your continued support for individuals with unique abilities in our state. Let me see if I can figure out how to advance the slide. All right. Our mission at the Agency for Persons with Disabilities is to support individuals with unique abilities and their families in living, learning, and working in their communities by creating multiple pathways to possibilities. APD is committed to increasing opportunities to serve individuals and their families at the earliest moment possible. The iBudget Florida waiver is APD's most traditional and recognized pathway to serve individuals with developmental disabilities. The iBudget Florida waiver is a home and community-based services Medicaid program that provides services to individuals in community-based settings that would otherwise require services in an institutional setting. We know that this is not only the right thing to do, but it's also more economical for the state. APD has the privilege to serve Floridians who are eligible for APD services as defined in Florida statutes. This includes individuals that are at least 3 years old and have a diagnosed developmental disability that occurred prior to the age of 18. Per Chapter 393 of the statutes, this includes individuals with severe forms of autism, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, intellectual disability, Phelan-McDermid syndrome, Prader-Willi syndrome, and spina bifida. As of November 1, our agency is serving over 61,000 individuals with developmental disabilities. Approximately 35 individuals are enrolled on the iBudget Florida waiver, and another approximately 21,000 individuals are assigned to pre-enrollment categories who've requested iBudget waiver services. We thought it might be helpful to provide a general roadmap from application for agency services and pre-enrollment processes for individuals who are seeking enrollment onto the iBudget waiver. Please note there may be additional pathways depending on an individual's circumstances and needs. As a first step, the individual applies for services, and APD assists the individual in establishing eligibility, and we assign a pre-enrollment category based on the statutory criteria. If the individual is in a crisis situation at the time of application or at any future time, we will facilitate immediate enrollment onto the iBudget waiver. We also make referrals to other community and resources and programs at the time of assignment to the pre-enrollment category. Once assigned, there's some required annual outreach for individuals, and I'll provide a little bit more about what we do a little bit later in the presentation. So this slide provides a breakdown of individuals in pre-enrollment categories based on their primary diagnosis. As you can see, over 52 individuals have a primary diagnosis of an intellectual disability. And then this slide provides information of individuals assigned to pre-enrollment categories by age. As you can see, 51% of the individuals are between the ages of 23 to 59, and about 29% of the individuals are between the ages of 15 and 22. Now, this slide provides a little more specificity into the individuals that are currently in pre-enrollment categories. Last session, thanks to the leadership of Representative Plakin and this body, we were able to achieve greater clarity and transparency for individuals who've raised their hand and asked for assistance, and this has evoked a call to action for our agency to provide services at the earliest moment possible. So individual circumstances can change over time, and as you know from your own personal situations, people are dynamic. So as such, through life's milestones and transitions, these priority categories are fluid because our individuals change every day. So this slide is a snapshot in time of our pre-enrollment categories. We also know that new people are moving to Florida every year, and this further impacts the fluidity of the pre-enrollment categories. So individuals being served in pre-enrollment categories, as I mentioned, they are assigned a category based on statutory criteria and their individual circumstances. So as you can see, there's seven different priority categories. There's no one listed in categories 1 and 2, because those individuals have an expedited path for waiver enrollment. Category 1 are individuals who are in crisis situations, and Category 2 are individuals in the child welfare system at the time of permanency or turning 18. Category 3 are individuals with intensive needs. Category 4 are individuals who we know have an aging caregiver. Category 5 are individuals transitioning from school. Category 6 are individuals ages 21 and older who don't meet other prioritization criteria. And then individuals in Category 7 are under the age of 21 and don't meet the other prioritization category. It's important to know that many of the individuals reflected in these categories are receiving services through other sources. So, for example, many individuals are receiving school services, and then also Medicaid recipients under the age of 21 can receive a suite of services through the Medicaid state plan. And we've found that about half the individuals in Category 7 are Medicaid eligible. Certainly, individuals who are experiencing any kind of immediate or time-limited needs are eligible for supplemental funding through our agency that we can provide to ensure the health, safety, and welfare of the individual. Now I want to talk a little bit about how APD assists individuals in pre-enrollment categories. Within 60 days of the eligibility determination, APD develops an abbreviated support plan, and the support plan identifies the supports and services needed by the individual. The statutes also require the agency to send an annual letter to individuals, and then during this check-in, what we're doing is verifying contact information, we're providing information about community resources, and we're also providing an opportunity for individuals to let us know if they have any unmet needs or changes in their lives. Sometimes individuals can receive services through individual and family supports funding, and this is temporary assistance that can be provided to meet critical needs. So for example, maybe we learn about an individual whose caregiver needs to have a brief and planned absence from caregiving. And in that case, we might be able to provide respite care. Another example might be an individual who has a one-time need for durable medical equipment. Another way that APD is able to support individuals in pre-enrollment categories is through our Hope Florida A Pathway to Possibilities program. Through this, we've been engaging in proactive outreach to individuals who are in pre-enrollment categories. What we've learned is that the top goals of individuals and families seeking services are, one, to maximize community integration, two, are to gain skills for independence, and three, are to obtain skills for employment. What's amazing about Hope Florida is that it provides an opportunity as a proactive way to provide solutions. I want to share a quick example. One of our Hope Navigators connected with a 45-year-old man with an intellectual disability who's living with his parents. And when our team met with the family, we learned that they were experiencing some financial hardship. So our Hope Navigator was able to connect the gentleman with the intellectual disability to employment services, and he's now starting a part-time job with Amazon. In addition to that, our Hope Navigator will continue to follow along with him and connect him to other community supports when he's not working. So again, thank you for allowing us to provide a brief overview of the pre-enrollment categories. We're incredibly thankful for your continued support to individuals with developmental disabilities in Florida.
Thank you. And I have a couple questions. I'll have a few at the beginning and a few at the end. But can we go back to page 7 to start? Okay. So these 210 people who are in this Category 3 intensive needs, and this isn't a gotcha question. I'm just trying to make sure we all understand. Why are the 210 people who have intensive needs not, why have they not cleared the wait list? Is it because we haven't appropriated enough money? I mean, like, why are they on the list? Intensive needs sounds like, you know, they need help. So why are they on it? You're recognized.
Thank you for asking that. It's a great question. And there's a couple contributing factors to that. One is, the individuals in Category 3, they don't meet crisis criteria. Some of them are, we think it's possible that in the next 12 months, their situation may change and they may meet crisis criteria. We have been grateful to funding that we received from the legislature, and we were able to offer enrollment to individuals in Categories 1 through 5, as well as individuals in Category 6. Since that time, some additional individuals have come to the agency and been assigned to Category 3.
So as a follow-up, so let's say one of these 210 people moved from intensive to crisis today. Do they automatically come off the wait list when they move from intensive to crisis? Is that just the way it works? You're recognized?
Thank you for asking that. And the answer is yes. If the individual meets a crisis criteria, we facilitate enrollment immediately.
All right. And then my last question before I open it up to everybody else is just for a sense for people. For these 293 people who are either in intensive needs or have parents that are, you know, most likely it's parents kind of getting older, and it's a lot. I mean, if their kids are, you know, 25 years younger. You could have someone 70 dealing with someone who's 45, someone around my age, for example. How much is the average cost to provide, would be just the ballpark, those 300 people? You're recognized.
So thank you for asking that question. I don't have cost information on pre-enrollment categories, but what I can tell you is I believe the average cost for the iBudget waiver is around $53,000 per year.
Per person?
Yes, per person.
Okay, so if we were to just multiply it out, just to give people a starting point to think about, so 300 people at $50,000 is $15 million. That's just math. All right, so I'll have more questions at the end, but does anyone else have any? We'll go with ranking member. Ranking member Skidmore, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Hope Florida, can you describe that for me a little bit? I'm not sure who Hope Florida is and where the funding comes in, how all of that works. Could you help me understand that?
You're recognized.
Thank you so much for asking. As you can tell, I'm very excited about our Hope Florida program. So at APD, we have 14 Hope Navigators, and they've been doing outreach to individuals who are in pre-enrollment categories. And so what they do is they connect with the individual and their family, assuming the individual chooses to participate. The individual shares what their needs are and what their goals are. And the Hope Navigator helps develop a care plan. And the care plan has specific connections to connect individuals to various resources. With the Hope Florida program, a lot of times the connections are through non-government resources. So we have a number of faith-based partners and community partners, as well as government partners to assist people.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it sounds like that's what APD is supposed to do. So I'm not sure. I don't really understand how Hope Florida is different than what you're doing. But if someone, and I'm not sure why anyone would say no if they were asked, but if they don't want to accept the resources, do they come off the wait list? Or if they do accept this opportunity for community resources, do they come off the wait list? And as a segue then, is pre-enrollment really just the wait list with a different name?
Thank you for asking wonderful questions. So I think what's different about Hope Florida from our requirements for community resource referrals is with Hope Florida, we're doing a more proactive outreach with definitive connections. So as opposed to just providing someone with a referral through the Hope Florida process, we're actually doing a warm handoff to make sure the individual is connected to a community support or a faith-based support to meet their needs. And then even when that connection's made, our Hope Navigators are following along with the individual through their journeys as their goals and needs change. So that's the fundamental difference. Now to your second question, as I mentioned before, there was some legislation passed last session. Pre-enrollment categories were previously called the waiting list. But as a result of that legislation, we felt that there is a call to action to serve individuals at the earliest moment possible. So two tangible actions through that has been Hope Florida, as well as just taking a deeper dive into the data and how it impacts our clients, as well as potential future needs of the individuals we serve.
You good? Okay, that's fine.
Time.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Brett Masula, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Deputy Director Fulcher, I want to thank you for not only your presentation, but all the hard work you do on behalf of our disabled citizens. I have a couple questions, Mr. Chair, if I may.
You may.
Well, thank you. My first question is, it seems like this pre-enrollment or wait list actually isn't that. It just seems like it's a different way that you're categorizing individuals that do not qualify for the waiver. I'd like you to try to drill down for us, if you can, on some of the criteria. For for instance, intellectual disabilities. You know, a lot of these criteria could be subjective based on a person's analysis. And I was just curious if this is indeed what it is because of budgetary constraints, as Chair Fine had mentioned, or is it something else? And if it is a true wait list, what is the average time for people to actually move up besides those two categories that you seem are not a wait list? They get in immediately. And I'd like to, if you could, drill down on some of those criteria.
You recognize.
Thank you so much for asking that. Just as a point of clarification, all the individuals that are in pre-enrollment categories have been determined, eligible for the iBudget waiver based on having one of the developmental disabilities in Florida statutes. The agency takes very seriously the eligibility determination process, and there are certain criteria spelled out both in statute and rule that would allow us to establish eligibility for someone with these diagnoses. To your second question, you were asking about the length of wait. We'll have to get back with you on the data. I don't have that with me today.
I'm going to have a little later. But just to, we'll take your question, but just to be clear, to be one of the 21,000 people on this list, it's not like, hey, I'm going to throw my name on it and anyone's on there. You've kind of gone through the people before. That this is sort of a checked list, a diligenced list of people. So theoretically, they qualify.
Yes, that's correct. When someone applies for services, we verify that they're domiciled in Florida and we're verifying their disability. So for example, if someone applies under spina bifida, we would be looking at verifiable medical records that the person has that condition.
Rep. Masullo, keep going.
If you could maybe try to give us some examples of the criteria that separates those individuals that qualify for those that are on the list. And I understand the age determination and why we're doing that, but let's just talk about those individuals that are in intensive needs, crisis. How do you compare what the difference is? We just try to understand that.
You're recognized.
Thank you. That's a very important question. Again, as I mentioned, when we do an eligibility determination, if we know that someone is in a crisis situation, we will facilitate immediate enrollment. We have check-ins with individuals about their needs, and then sometimes individuals reach out to us without us contacting them to let us know that something's changed. Sometimes individuals raise their hand and let us know that they're seeking enrollment onto the waiver through the crisis process. And so there's criteria for that in both statute and rule that we follow. It includes helping the individual obtain documentation to support what's going on in their lives, and then we make a decision based on the criteria.
Follow up? Are you good? Okay. Rep. Snyder, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and again, thank you so much for being here and for the work of your team. My first question actually was already covered by Representative Masullo, just talking about kind of the application process, but just to take that the next step, do you have an idea how long it typically takes to make that determination once the application has been submitted?
You're recognized.
Thank you for asking. The timeframes for the application process are spelled out in the statute. Memory serves correct, if someone is requesting crisis at the time, we have 45 days. However, the statute also acknowledges that we do have to collect documentation to support, you know, individuals' needs. And so the statute gives us 90 days to make a decision from receipt of the application.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just from a technology perspective and kind of, you know, from a the Floridian's perspective and probably a caregiver who's having to provide this documentation. Can you just talk a little bit about how that happens? Is that a something you can snap a picture from your cell phone? How do you receive that and then make that determination?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. We want to help individuals provide it in a way that's as streamlined as possible for them. Sometimes we assist individuals in obtaining records. Sometimes they already have evaluations and medical records, and we'll help reach out to their medical professionals or their schools to obtain it. Sometimes individuals provide documentation to us, and we'll accept it in any format. And then other times an individual knows they're having challenges, but they don't necessarily have supporting documentation. And so sometimes our agency will provide for a comprehensive evaluation to help establish eligibility.
Thank you.
Representative Cross, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Deputy Director, for this presentation. I noticed at the beginning you used the term unique abilities. Can you explain a little bit why some of the state agencies are moving towards that terminology and what, if any, feedback you've received from actual members of the disabled community?
Thank you for asking that question. We certainly have traveled around the state and met different families and advocates that refer to their loved ones as having a unique ability. What we're trying to do is elevate and empower individuals. The term is very strength-based, and we want to enrich the lives of individuals with developmental disabilities and other unique abilities in a big way. And so that term is a strength-based term. We also recognize that there are several other programs that use that term, so we're trying to make processes more clear for individuals seeking services.
Yes, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will the state be coming up with a formal definition for that, and how will that work collaboratively with some of the federal programs and protections around people with disabilities?
You're recognized.
Thank you for asking. I'd have to look into that a little more. As you know, the pre-enrollment categories that we presented today are specifically related to individuals with developmental disabilities, and those are very well defined in the statutes.
Okay, you good? All right, Whip Anderson, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for your presentation. I'm curious if you can comment a little bit about if you have data on what percentage or numbers of these claims that are approved versus ones that are denied. And for someone who has a claim that's denied, what does that appeals process look like?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Are you speaking to an eligibility claim or?
Yeah, so you said that people say, hey, I should be on the wait list, and you don't just stick them on. You do some sort of vetting process so that these 21,000 people have been vetted. I think Whip Anderson's question is, what percentage of the people who say, hey, I should be on the wait list, get told no? And is it 1%? Is it 0%, 10%, 90%? What percent get told no, roughly? And then if they disagree, what is their recourse? Is that a good way of phrasing it?
Spot on. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, sir.
Good question.
It is a great question. I apologize. I do not have the data on approvals and denials with me today. We can certainly provide that information at a future time. If an individual is approved or denied, the agency provides them a letter with the basis for the decision made.
Are you good?
Yes, go ahead. Just follow up. Thank you, Chair. And then what is the process for an appeal? So if they're denied and they get that letter, then what if they disagree?
You're recognized.
Thank you for asking that. Individuals do have appeal rights, and the letter that we provide provides it. They can request a hearing, and the hearings are held through the Department of Children and Families with a hearing officer.
Okay. All right. Representative Edmonds, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for your presentation. You're doing a phenomenal job answering our questions. Could you go back to slide 6 for me, please? My question is very simple. I'm just curious why age group 23 and 59 is so big in range, and is there any incentive to, I guess, separate those age groups so we can see how to prioritize and budget for generations and ages appropriately?
We can just ask that for follow-up as well as the question that Whip Anderson asked. You know, if you could maybe send us a follow-up that broken down a little bit if you don't know. You may have an answer. Go ahead.
I appreciate you asking that, and I think I can answer part of that. I don't know what prompts the number of individuals in the categories, but I can tell you we see that 50% are between the ages 23 to 59. And we've also spent a lot of time looking at the individuals who've qualified for crisis services. And we see that the average age for someone to meet crisis criteria is 26. And so we're seeing that a lot of times individuals are looking for services like adult day training, personal supports, transportation, and companion. And so that tells us that maybe there's a need as people are transitioning into adulthood to make sure they have services in place.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that answer. It really was helpful. In your experience, have you seen someone maybe who's 23 versus someone who's 59 be a little bit more or less expensive, especially as we have like a growing age of boomers? Do you think that it's going to be a little bit even more expensive in the future to cover those costs?
You recognize.
Thanks for asking that. I don't have any data with me today about average cost by age.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Anyone else, before we come back, anyone else who hasn't asked a question, want to ask one? Okay. Ranking Member Skidmore, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to talk about the individual and family support services. What's the typical amount that you would spend per year on that IFS program?
You're recognized.
Thank you so much. So the Individuals and Family Supports Funds, they aren't necessarily an annual approval like our iBudget program. It's very tailored to an individual need. So a lot of times we're meeting a one-time or temporary need, and so it's based solely on the individual.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is there anyone who has requested that funding and there wasn't any funding to support their request? Is there a little pot of money, and once it's used up, it's used up?
You're recognized.
Thank you for asking that. The pot of funding is finite. At this time, I'm not aware of denying funding based on lack of funding. Sometimes individuals will request things that are not covered through those, or they'll request things that they can get through other programs. And so we want to make sure we're good stewards of the funds that we have.
Good.
One last question, no, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That just prompted a recollection that we've spent many years trying to increase the funding for the APD wait list. And now I think that it's understood that there's millions, if not hundreds of millions, that have not been spent. Can you explain why that funding isn't being expended and what the plan is to make sure that we do that?
You're recognized. So I'm not sure what funding hasn't been spent, but...
Yeah, I was kind of going to ask for a follow-up. I'm not sure about funding for waiting lists that you're mentioning.
Was your question, it sounded like you believe that there's money that some of these people could be cut. There's money that we've allocated that hasn't been spent. So let's ask that. Do you have, like, extra money sitting around that you're not spending on folks on this list?
So thanks. That's a really great question. Certainly, we take any funding that's entrusted to us very seriously, and we look to spend it as strategically as possible to make sure that we're serving as many individuals as possible with the funds appropriated. So there's two factors that contribute to our flow of funding. One is the point in time that someone is enrolled onto the iBudget waiver, because this can occur periodically through a fiscal year. And the second is that individuals usually reach their cost plan maturity on the iBudget waiver by year three. So these two components are what's reverted and reappropriated in a non-recurring category so that we can make sure from day one we're taking into account any delta and planning to make sure we're not overextending in future years.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is there any situation in which there's funding available but not a provider available for that level of funding for an individual? Is there any instances where you have the money but you can't find a provider to provide those services?
You're recognized.
Thank you for asking that. We have different safeguards in place to try to connect individuals to providers. Individuals who are served through the iBudget waiver have a waiver support coordinator to connect them to providers. And then if we're assisting someone through IFS funds, someone at the agency works to connect individuals to providers. If someone was having a challenge finding a provider, they could certainly reach out to our agency and we could help on an individualized basis.
Okay. So I'm going to do something I don't normally do, but I appreciate the folks who came to watch today. So I actually have a little information I want to share with the committee about this subject, but if any member of the public wants to talk about this issue after I do that, you know, you're welcome to do it. You just need to fill out a card. If nobody does, that's fine too. I'm just going to, since we're only 35 minutes in, I'm going to throw out that opportunity for folks. But one thing I did want to share with folks before that, or maybe we're done, is how long people are waiting. Now, I don't have that. If we go back to slide 7, I don't have this cross-indexed with the 210 and the 83. It's just the total numbers. But I thought it'd be interesting, and I'm going to ask as follow-up to get that data indexed by how long they've been waiting. So keep in mind, I don't know whether these people are in which of the 3 to 7 they're in. But to give you a sense, and I'm just going to do percentages, 6% of the people on this list have been waiting a year or less. 10%, 1 to 2 years, another 10%, 2 to 3 years, 11%, 3 to 4 years, 5%, and I'm rounding, 5%, 4 to 5 years, 5%, 5 to 6 years, 5%, 6 to 7 years, 4%, 7 to 8 years, 4%, 8 to 9 years, 3%, 9 to 10 years, and 37% more than 10 years. Again, I don't know how that indexed up, but that's something that we'll ask to get as we move forward from here. Does anybody, any of the public wishing to speak? Not seeing a lot of interest? Okay. Well, then if that's it, then we're done for today. I want to thank everybody for coming, and hopefully maybe we'll work on this year. As I said, we measure a society by, oh, did somebody want to? I heard. No? Okay. We measure society by how we take care of folks like this. And so I'm glad that we kind of brought a little light to this as well. But with that, we are done. I want to wish everybody a happy Hanukkah and a Merry Christmas. This concludes our agenda. Oh, yeah, thank you for coming and thank you for testifying. Happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas to everybody. And this will be our last meeting, and I'll see you after the first of the year. With that, Representative Masula moves we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.